how you tune the guitar is you play it and you listen. And then you can go string by string. And so string by string may be the domains of my life. It may be like, how are my relationships doing with my friends? How's my health? How's it going for me and in my work and in doing meaningful work, right? So those are the strings of our guitar that we can go string by string and to make. Sometimes it's little micro adjustments, like, I just need to tweak this a little bit, right? And I need to add a little bit more rest. Sometimes it's big macro adjustments, like, I need to withdraw from school. I need to leave this job.
That was Diana Hill, and this is Mentally Flexible. Welcome to Mentally Flexible, where we have meaningful conversations to help you build mental flexibility. I'm Tom Parks. I'm a licensed psychotherapist, and in each episode, I'll be talking to people who inspire me most on topics related to psychology, mental health, and creativity. My hope is that through these conversations, you'll better understand yourself, others, and the world around you. Thanks for being here, and I hope you enjoy the podcast. Oh, in time. My guest today is Diana Hill. Diana Hill is a clinical psychologist and author of ACT Daily Journal, Get Unstuck and Live Fully with Acceptance and Commitment Therapy. She is also a co-host of the popular podcast Psychologists Off the Clock, where she has interviewed leaders in the field of psychology, mindfulness, and wellness. Through her online teaching, executive coaching, clinical supervision, and therapy practice, Diana encourages clients to build psychological flexibility so that they can live more meaningful and fulfilling lives. Diana has a knack for unpacking complex, science-based concepts and making them applicable to daily life and work, parenting, relationships, and health. In this episode, we explore a range of topics, including the role of spirituality in Diana's life, the universality of pain and suffering, the origins of Psychologists Off the Clock and her new book that she co-authored, ACT Daily Journal, the value of connecting to a collective identity, and allowing space to tune up your values in life. I love this conversation with Diana, as we have a lot in common when it comes to our interests in spirituality, ACT, and cultivating meaning in life. I really appreciated her vulnerability throughout this episode, as she shared a lot about her own healing journey. And thank you all for coming back to another episode of the podcast. I'm honored to be going through this process with you. If it's your first time listening, welcome to the show. If you'd like to support the podcast, please subscribe and leave a review. And you can follow me on Instagram at Mentally Flexible to get updates and bonus content. All right. Well, without further delay, here is my conversation with Diana Hill. Your experiences within the spirituality realm of studying with Thich Nhat Hanh, and I know you've had other experiences in ashram, like that's the stuff about you that most makes me interested in you and like wanting to get to know you better. And that doesn't have to be in this podcast, but I guess just to validate that, that's something I really appreciate about you.
Yeah. You know, it's interesting, Thomas, because it's only been recently that I've been talking more about that. And I do these Tuesday teachings every week. And it's just a little sangha that I do through the Mindful Hearts program. And I kind of created something like, what would I want to do on a Tuesday night? I'd want to move a little bit and sit a little bit. And but I'm going to be on a retreat and taking a little break. And I was thinking about who I would want to have on as a guest speaker. And I was racking my brain. First, I'm going to have my postdoc come on because she's excellent. She has all this experience in chronic pain and cancer and all this. And she's really interesting. But the second week, I was like, who am I going to have on? Who am I going to have on? And then finally, I thought, oh, I should have my dad on. Mm. And my dad is he's a Buddhist teacher. And he's actually the person that introduced me to Thich Nhat Hanh, because he was a follower of Thich Nhat Hanh for many, many years and would go to Plum Village and spend time with him. And I have spent much of my life in a self story that I am not my dad. And that being because I grew up in a Catholic school, I went to Catholic school. My mom was a Spanish teacher. And side story is that my mom grew up in Peru and she was fluent in Spanish and she became a Spanish teacher. So I went to Catholic school, and as a Catholic, going to Catholic school and not being a Catholic is a little bit challenging because you don't know, like you can't take communion, you're not part of the group, and you don't really belong. You don't know what to say when the priest says something back to you. I was sort of like, I knew I wanted the little white dress that the other girls got to wear. And I was always a little bit ashamed of when people would come over to my house and there would be all this Buddhist iconography and there would be like incense and my dad's saffus on the floor. It was embarrassing to me. And what happens, I think, when we have parts of us that we get embarrassed of, it's because we have a longing to belong. And what can happen when we have that longing to belong is that we can create a self story that I am this or I am not that, so I can be part of, right? So I created this self story around, I am not my dad. I'm not my dad. And I think that's even kind of linked to maybe this whole spirituality conversation we're having, because in my efforts to not be my dad, I had never taught with him, even though he's a teacher in this area. We haven't joined forces, even though he is in my town. And so in that moment, when I was thinking about who I'd bring on to be a guest teacher, I noticed that self-story, I'm not my dad. And then I also noticed my values that have come to light, especially more during this pandemic, which are values around my relationship with my elders. And I think a lot of people have experienced that during the pandemic, of this feeling of our elders are fragile. They're not always going to be here. Our time with them is limited, maybe even more limited than we thought. And how do I want to be in relationship to my elders? How do I want to be loving? I want to be compassionate. I want to be forgiving. And so I ended up asking my dad to come on and be a guest speaker and challenge that self story of I am not my dad. And that actually sometimes I'm a lot like my dad and sometimes I'm not. But yes. That just made me think of that when you were talking about maybe that's part of the spirituality part of why I don't talk so much about it.
Yeah. So was it hard for you to reconcile how that story you had of not being your dad as these more authentic interests in spirituality grew in you as you got older, how to balance both that story and these interests that you had?
Yeah. I mean, I kept it very separate. You know, I'm not my dad, so I'm not going to become a Buddhist teacher. I'm going to become a yoga teacher.
It's a loophole.
It's a loophole. Yeah. And I think we do that, right? Our efforts to not be something, to say, I am not this, I am this, we actually, the very thing that you don't want is the thing that you become, right? And so that's been sort of an interesting thing for me to look at as my efforts to run away from this have actually circled back around it again. And really, I want to practice acceptance, you know, acceptance of him, acceptance of me. And if you go back to even the root teachings of Thich Nhat Hanh, some of his teachings are things like when you eat a piece of food, recognize that you're eating the sun that's in that food and that the sun is becoming you and you are now the sun, right? So Thich Nhat Hanh is very much focused on the interconnection of things, right? And he even has meditations that are meditations that you do with your ancestors to recognize how your ancestors are living within you. And so ultimately, I am my dad just as much as I am you and you are me. We are all, you know, interconnected just like I am the sun and the sun is in my food. So that's more of the place that I want to be residing in now rather than running away.
Yeah. Well, it makes sense that people like you and I who have this very innate interest in spirituality find our way to ACT because there's a real openness to integrate all of that into the ACT approach.
Yeah, Absolutely. It's woven. One of the posts I've been posting more on Instagram recently, and one of the posts that I did was a teaching that I did in a workshop, which was, I'm sure people have heard of the Four Noble Truths. Mm-hmm. Buddhism. So the Four Noble Truths are life is suffering. There's a cause for that suffering. Freedom from suffering is possible. And the Eightfold Path is the way. And one of the things that I posted was the sometimes four noble-ish truths of ACT that, and you have to put the sometimes in there and the ish, because that makes it more ACT-y, right? That we're not holding too tightly to any of this, but the sometimes four noble-ish truths of ACT is that pain is part of life and, or can be part of life. Just to be human is to experience pain, and that our efforts to emotionally or experientially avoid is very much the cause of our suffering, right? So experiential avoidance are things like distracting or rushing through or checking out or opting out or not feeling or I'm not my dad, right? Those are our experiential avoidance that causes a lot of suffering. And then in ACT, there's also the belief that freedom from suffering is also possible, that we can have those moments where all of a sudden I feel like I can move towards this thing that I've been saying I'm not, and say, hey, Dad, can you come on my talk on Tuesday? I love you, right? So freedom in that moment, that's a free moment that I was free to choose my actions, not because of my self-story, because of my anxiety, but because of a longing within me that's connected to my values. So freedom is possible. But in ACT, the freedom that the fourth noble-ish sometimes truth would be psychological flexibility is a way. That the practices around psychological flexibility are a way in which we can navigate life a little bit more effectively and freely and from a place of choice. So those are the four sometimes noble-ish truths of ACT, but they map on really, really well to these really ancient Buddhist teachings. And I get sort of so like interested in that, like, where do these things line up? And part of them may line up because sure, Steve Hayes was from the 60s and 70s, when some of these ideas were kind of finding their way into psychology. But part of them line up, part of the reason why they line up is because this is just human condition. And ACT is a model that is a big, broad understanding of how humans work, how our minds work, how we avoid pain and we move towards rewards, right? Short-term reward-based learning, right? And so because it's a model of how humans work, it will map on to also people that have been studying how human minds work for many thousands of years. It's just different angles in.
Very beautifully said. Yeah, agreed. And that first noble-ish truth is so important and can be such a pressure release for people to have that flip of consciousness to understand that suffering is the baseline for us all, rather than a signal that something's wrong. It's just a signal that you're human.
Yeah. Yeah. And I would say pain. I mean, actually, when they dissect the Buddhist first noble truth around life is suffering, some different interpretations of it are just life is uncomfortable. And I think sometimes we like suffering is such a big bog down, but it's more like life is just uncomfortable. And we're naturally designed to just kind of find our comfort zones. And that works well when you want to find like a cozy bed to climb into or a nice home and make a little nest, right, for your family life. But where it doesn't work so well is when we're trying to find our comfort zones in stuff that shows up under our skin, and those comfort zones keep our lives really narrow and limited, right? So as I mentioned, I worked as a clinical director of a IOP for eating disorders prior to going into private practice. And if you look at something like anorexia, it is what happens when your comfort zone has gotten smaller and smaller and smaller and smaller and smaller. And now your life has gotten incredibly narrow, right? And rigid, but you feel comfortable in this little tiny, tiny little space, right? Of living. So in ACT, it's almost like trying to get comfortable with more discomfort, expanding our zones of comfort with discomfort, not necessarily getting rid of discomfort.
Yeah. And what's cool about ACT and looking at things from a process-based level is you realize how many different things that look differently on the outside, different disorders, the topography is different, follow a very similar pattern of just making your life smaller and smaller and smaller and smaller. It can be social anxiety. It could be your depression. It can be what we call OCD, but all of these things follow a similar pattern of really closing your life in and at the cost of missing out on things that are important to you.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah.
I feel like that's the brilliance of it, right? Is that, you know, I've been looking at my bookshelf over here and I can see all these different books. There's the bipolar disorder workbook. There's the, you know, bulimia workbook. There's a workbook for every disorder and condition out there, and I own most of them. And then there's sort of just the ACT model, which is welcomes all, right? Because your experience within each of these conditions, there's differences. I mean, bipolar disorder is different from bulimia. There's different mm-hmm. brain chemistry and things like that happening. But it's how you respond in life that really makes a difference. And I'm also kind of interested in what about not calling things a disorder anymore?
Yeah.
Right. Yeah.
Agreed. Agreed. I always try to support clients in that understanding to hold the disorders they come in with lightly, is to realize that it's not like there are the normal, healthy people that don't have anything wrong with them over here. And then there's the people with disorders over here. It's just, we're all a mix in there on a spectrum.
Yeah. And context really matters, right? Because one of the things that I follow the Stress in America survey, and I've been following it since the pandemic. It used to come out once a year, and then they started doing it monthly during the pandemic. And what the Stress in America survey started showing was that at one point, like in June 2020, 72% of Americans were saying that this was the lowest point in their lifetime. Half of U.S. adults were saying that they were engaging in behaviors that were problematic as a result of the stress, right? And so we see that when life gets stressful, it is normal and human to want to avoid and control. And it's normal and human to have behaviors that show up that in the short term maybe bring you a little bit of relief, but long term are not helpful for you. This is just the nature of humans. And to call it a disorder, I think is sometimes can also just keep us trapped. It keeps us from actually finding the solution to the way out.
Totally. Because in the same way that you fused with that self story related to your dad, it's so easy to fuse to certain self stories around your disorder that really narrow the lens you look at yourself and the world through.
Yeah. Yeah. I think the other thing is that you can have, quote, this disorder and you can still operate differently even with it. So in that same Stress in America survey, at the same point in time when people were saying this was the worst time in history, they also reported that 3 in 5 U.S. adults were saying, the parents were saying that they were really enjoying this time at home with their kids. They were really meaningful. And that there was a majority of U.S. adults who were also saying they were taking action against racism. Mm. And so even in the face of suffering or in the face of this is, you know, things are not going so well in my life, I can also become psychologically flexible in the way that I look at what really matters in this moment and I turn towards that, even if nothing were to change in the context that I live.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I think all of us can look back on our lives and find moments in which we could say that the pain or the suffering or the anxiety was really high. But also a lot of times we can see that that was the thing that facilitated something really meaningful. So they often go hand in hand.
Yeah. Yeah. They often go hand in hand.
Yeah. I know that now you've since ACT and the model of psychological flexibility had such a big impact on the way you lived your life and the way you help clients. I know that you and a colleague wrote a book called ACT Daily. Can you share a little bit about that?
Sure. Debbie Sorensen is my friend first and podcast co-host second, and then now co-author third. And Debbie's a psychologist in Denver, and we met actually through another friend of ours, and we were on a retreat. We sort of this group of women psychologists all get together and support each other. And we go on these retreats and we just spend time together for a weekend. We're all moms and talk about our lives. And on this, I remember the night we were all in our bathrobes and some were drinking wine and we were, you know, eating snacks and talking about psychology and the research and how we apply it to our lives. And I think one of us said, wouldn't someone want to be a fly on the wall right now, listening to these women talk about this psychology research, evidence-based approaches, and how they are applying it in their lives and their relationships, and then also giving support to each other. And so that's how the podcast was born. Debbie was already doing a podcast at the time called New Books in Psychology that was reviewing psychology books. And Debbie, myself, and Ray got together, started to launch this Psychologist Off the Clock podcast. And few years down the road, we've been doing it for about 4 years now and have had a lot of people on that we really admire and have learned a lot from. We now have Jill Stoddard and Yael Schonbrunn on the show as co-hosts. But along the way, Debbie and I have been using ACT in our clinical practice and in our own lives and on the podcast as a team. And we were talking, I don't even remember how it came about, but we were just talking about, wouldn't it be great if people had access to these technologies, but they didn't have to go to a therapist or have a disorder to use them. Like, these are sort of, it's like when I was using DBT, I'm like, why didn't they, when I first learned DBT, I was like, why didn't they just teach us this in school? This is the basics of emotion regulation. This could be helpful stuff. So how to name an emotion. But so we started writing this journal. It's called the ACT Daily Journal, and it goes through the six core processes of ACT and psychological flexibility in a really tangible, simple, concrete way. And then you get to apply those skills in your life through journaling practice and through little small micro practices on a day-to-day basis. And what we know about learning is that learning is best done when it's through repetition. Learning is best done when it's experiential. Learning is best done when it has some kind of emotional content, right? You're going to remember things when they're linked to emotions as well. And so this journal accesses all of that. And then Debbie and I do these little vignettes throughout where we talk about little metaphor. I love metaphors. So little metaphors and stories about how we use ACT in our daily lives. And it's really quite sweet. I feel good about it. And that's something that you want to feel when you're putting a book out into the world, is to feel good about it. I hope it helps people. It's accessible, I think, both to therapists. We kind of envision like the therapist is doing this and then their client's doing it too. And you're building psychological flexibility together.
I love it. Yeah. I'm always really fascinated about the process people go through of having an idea or something that really, an idea that energizes them and seeing it through to completion. What was it like from first having this idea with Debbie to actually making it happen? Can you share a little bit about that?
Oh gosh, it taught me about a few things. One, we had no idea that we were going to be writing a book during a pandemic. Psychological flexibility of all things. Super helpful and super hard, right? So here we are, moms, practitioners with podcasts, and we're writing a book, and then a pandemic hits. And so that was rough, which led to, it taught me a lot about friendship. Mm-hmm. And Debbie is one of my dearest friends and most supportive people in my life. And so there were moments in time where we felt like there's no way we can do this. And we had each other's back because luckily those moments in time weren't always at the same time. So I could call her and say, I'm just like maxed out. Can you take this? Can you run with this for this week? And she would say, absolutely. And then she would support me and I would support her in the same. And so the understanding of we're not alone in doing hard things. There are people that we need, that we can lean on, people that love us, and that it's okay to ask for help. And it's okay to say, I can't do all of this right now. That was a big lesson for me in writing this book. The first chapter is all about self-care and self-compassion, And we did that on purpose because we actually, I remember chatting with her and being like, oh my gosh, we need this one. If we're going to be writing this thing, let's start here. And we had both self-compassion, but also deep, deep compassion for each other that we were in, that we were in it together.
Wow, Diana, the moment I asked you that question and you connected with that experience of having Debbie in your life and going through this, really strong emotion came up for you. I know this isn't going to be on video, but tell me about that. It sounds like connecting with how important Debbie was for you in this process really touched something.
Yeah. You know, friendship is something that is newer for me. I'm in my 40s, but it really wasn't only until probably my late 30s that I started understanding what it means to be a friend and how to be a friend. I've lived a very achievement-oriented life, and I tend towards believing that I'm an introvert or have a story that I'm introverted, and I also have experienced a lot of things in my life that have led me to be more independent, and so, and I think that's one of the reasons why I went into private practice. So joining this podcast and learning also about friendship and the importance of friendship has been a real growth area for me. And also in becoming a mom has been really important to me. And being a woman in the workplace and a woman that's wanting to pursue career goals and having groups of women and that are professional women around me and supportive of me in this intimate way has been a growth edge and also really rewarding. And I see the sort of like the weaving of friends, like the tapestry of friends that strengthens me in my life. So
I love that.
Yeah. So that's what Debbie is. And there's many, you know, I co-teach homeschool and my dear, dear friend co-teaches with me, and there's no way I could do it without her, right? We've got each other's back. And I think when we start to think about just community in general, that if we could take that approach of having each other's back and supporting each other and being part of a collective, part of a greater whole, that sometimes we pick up the slack. Sometimes we have to work harder because we've had this privilege. Sometimes, you know, we need to give more of ourselves. Sometimes we need to take care of ourselves. So being able to, and when I say work harder because we've had this privilege, what I mean is that I really do believe that people that are in privileged positions need to be working hard right now to end racism and to end oppression and to make a change around, make big systemic change. It is the responsibility, and I would say for myself in that position. But yeah, I think trying to think about things more collectively and this summer, I had a chance to interview the Psychology of Radical Healing Collective. And when I invited Helen Neville, I invited Helen Neville to be on the show because she was the one of the core people that wrote the APA guidelines of race and on race and ethnicity. And I wanted her to come on and talk about that. And first she said, well, I'm going to come on, but I'm not going to talk about that. And second of all, I'm going to come on and I'm going to bring this group of people with me that are the collective, the Psychology Radical Healing Collective. These are the people that I want to also have be on your show and to be talking about these important issues around racism and oppression. And when I started reading her stuff, I started learning that the way that they write their blogs is all together and collectively. The way that they write their papers is together collectively. And when they came on the show, they came on as a collective in supporting each other. And that's more some of the values that I want to be pursuing in my life is how to work more collectively towards good.
I love that. I mean, it feels like there's so much pressure, whether that's just we place on ourselves or externally, and probably a mix of both, to lead towards this very independent way of living and connecting with that more community oriented collective approach to things is in our bones. That's how we were designed to be. And there's something really nourishing about that.
Yeah. And it's in our bones, but it's not always easy. Right, because there's another part of our brain. There's definitely this, the part of our brain that's involved in social engagement and involved in, you know, that gets regulated by experiencing compassion and giving compassion. But there's also another part of us that creates others and does othering and wants to hold, doesn't feel like there's enough and wants to hold on to our little piece or wants to self-promote, right? And so that is very alive and well in humans and the competitive drive part of our brain. And I'm interested in this idea that the striving and drive that a lot of us get hooked by is actually an experiential avoidance loop, right? So we feel uncomfortable. We feel like there's not enough. We feel like there's some core basic need not being met. And so we have to go strive and go get that thing. With our blinders on, our attention is quite narrowed when we're in drive mode, right? And we don't pay attention to the collective, which maps on a lot to Paul Gilbert's work and sort of the three kind of emotion regulation systems of we have the threat system, we have a drive system, and then we have a compassionate soothing system. But when we're in drive, just as well as when we're in threat, we often don't pay attention to the fact that, hey, here's Debbie over here. She can help me out. And then I can help Debbie too, right? We're just like, shut down, I'm in threat, this is scary, you know, I'm alone in this. Or when we're in drive, we don't think, okay, how could I make my drive and my striving benefit more? We just think, okay, I'm in drive, I need to promote my thing or, you know, get more money or become more whatever, beautiful, have more things, as opposed to thinking more collectively. And that third system, which is the more social engagement system, is so nice because it can help our threat and our drive get more reoriented, get more, you know, feelings of safeness, feelings of interconnectedness, and then turn our drive and striving for the good.
Yeah, I love that. And there's almost just this leap of faith you can take to trust that if you give more in your relationships, whether it's people you know directly or the world at larger, there's a faith that it'll all play out the way it needs to play out. When you need, it'll come back to you instead of trying to like have strings attached every time you feel like you're giving more than you're getting.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting because I'm a beekeeper on the side and, mm-hmm. or my family, we keep bees. And one of the things that when you have a hive that you do, you often will name your hive. But when you name a hive, it has like 50,000 bees in it. But when you name a hive, you usually just give it one name. So we have Norm. And Norm is one of our hives. And the name is just one name because although there's 50,000 organisms within this hive, they're all working together to one collective whole, right? And so one group of bees, they're the pollinators. They go out and get the pollen and bring it back. And then you have another group of bees, which are the guard bees. And they're so cute. They just stand there at the door, guarding the door, make sure no yellow jackets come in. Or I go down and visit them in the morning. And I go down without a bee suit just to go say hi to my bees. And I go down there. And as long as you don't cross in front of the door, they're fine because I have this little door in the back. That's just a little window that you can open up and look in and you can see them all in there making their honey. But every once in a while, one of those guard bees will catch a smell that I'm there. And it'll come over and it'll just kind of circle around me and it'll tell me it's time for you to kind of leave. You've gotten a little close. And if I'm paying attention and I'm mindful, I listen to the guard bee and I leave, right? So that's the guard bee's job. And then there's little nursery bees that just take care of the little babies and feed them royal jelly and, you know, the little thing called bee bread where they mix together pollen and a little bit of honey and it's super nutritious and they make their little bee bread. So it's so sweet, right? This hive. And humans aren't that different. But what happens is we start fighting with each other in our own hive, or we start saying, this is mine and this is yours, or I am this and I'm not that. And that causes a lot of suffering, right? Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's hard, right? Because so much of the context of our society reinforces the importance of the individual. Yeah. And so that without some real intention, that's the sort of flow of the river that we fall into. Mm-hmm. But I know when I a really powerful experience for me is when I spent a summer in Ghana and seeing how different things were there. And I was in this village and it really felt like that whole village was kind of like the beehive, where they were, the sense of identity was with the community rather than any particular individual, where I was stunned by like kids just following me for a mile, like away from their parents, young kids. And the part of me that goes, well, don't you need to like tell your parents? And this isn't a direct quote, but essentially they're like, no, everyone's our parents, mm-hmm. you know, like everybody's looking out for everybody. And it was a really beautiful experience for me to just see how we can have our sense of identity be outside of just that little person riding around in our heads.
Yeah, it's really touching. And I think that in our own way, I think a lot of people have felt that during the pandemic, during our experiences of moments where you felt maybe felt supported or connected to people, and that you're not alone in it. And ultimately that makes us feel safer. Yeah. So you can roam when you feel safe. This is the nature of, and I don't mean safe in terms of comfortable. I mean safe in that you have a freedom to choose. You can, you have more room to move in your life, and then you can start going places where your mind is telling you can't go, which is really exciting. It's exciting to have those moments where your mind is saying, okay, you can't do this. You should do this. You shouldn't do that. And you still do it. That's quite liberating, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I imagine you had to use that at different points in the beginning phases of writing this book or journal, right? Where there were, right in the beginning, it probably felt really overwhelming and there was probably a lot of reasons in your head why you couldn't do it. And you had to flex that muscle of noticing that and still moving forward.
Yeah. You know, it's actually interesting because I haven't felt that as much with writing this journal because in some ways, my outcome wasn't so connected to performance. Mm-hmm. It wasn't a striving thing for me. It was more of, this is all stuff that Debbie and I know and that we love and we support each other in. I mean, there was like the drudgery of, okay, we got to like go through another round of edits and we have to take this many words and make it into this many words. Are you kidding me? How are we gonna do that? But I didn't feel that as much in that arena. I feel that in other areas of my life, more in areas where I think like in areas of social justice, that's something that I did not get a really great training on. I did get a good training around being ethnoculturally competent when I was in internship, but much of my graduate training was very white centric and male centric training. And so areas where I feel like, I don't know a lot about this is uncomfortable. It's a really uncomfortable place for me. And so I've been trying to step more into those areas recently, because places that I don't know a lot, then that's probably an area where I have some learning, some growth mindset, some new ways to look at the world that could benefit my clinical practice, the podcast, my parenting.
Yeah. Yeah. That's a really good point that it's a lot easier to take make those towards moves when it's something we feel confident in.
Yeah.
And when we don't have that same sense of confidence or education or training in something, it takes a lot more of that willingness to go into the discomfort.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
What's that for you, Mike? What is that for you, Thomas? Like, do you have areas that...
Yeah. I mean, I think this podcast is a huge one for me right now. It's very intimidating for me to be in this position right now of speaking and knowing that there's going to be people around the world that I don't know listening to it. And it took a lot of willingness to accept insecurities and discomfort within myself to be willing to even start this and to continue to keep doing it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. It was interesting because I was talking to my son's preschool's teacher on the first day of school many, many years ago. And she said, she was like 65 years old, 70 years old. And she said, you know, every night before the first day of school, I just can't sleep. I get so anxious. She's been doing this for years, like over 20 years. She'd been teaching preschool and she gets anxious, right? And I looked at her and I was like, yeah, isn't that just human, right? Like we just get anxious about the things that we care about. You must really care about teaching preschool. I'm so glad you're my son's teacher. I'm so lucky. You know?
Yeah.
And so you think about, okay, what are my sleepless nights about? And my sleepless nights are about the things that are most important, often most important to me. Sometimes it's like, did I need to turn off the stove or, you know, things like that. But often it's, I'm really, you know, anxious about school reopening again and how is that going to impact, you know, kids and families, or I'm really anxious about this interview that I'm about to do because I really care about this topic. And, or even I care about what people think about me because I care about my place in the world.
Yeah.
And I want to belong. And that longing to belong is just such a human thing.
Yeah. And that's why I love people like Kelly Wilson, who I know had a big impact on you. And we both had the opportunity to interview and he shared in, which I loved the interview you did with him, by the way. And he shared in the beginning of my conversation with him about how he still gets really scared and anxious before giving talks. And this is somebody that so many people look up to, and he's had so much experience in the field. And so there's something really validating about hearing people like Kelly Wilson, who we both respect, really admire, talk about still coming into that place of feeling scared and vulnerable, even when they've had a lot of success. I don't really like the word success, but whatever we want to call it.
Yeah. They've been marked as achieved.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. I know that I was reading something you wrote about your journey, and I read that going to a presentation or a training by Kelly Wilson was something that really impacted you. Could you share a little bit more about that?
Yeah. Well, Kelly was sort of my entry point into ACT and in graduate school. And I really struggled. Well, struggled before graduate school, but I struggled in graduate school as well. And one of the things that I struggled with when I was a graduate student was a feeling that I was in a very cognitive behavioral program, and I felt like as a student, as a therapist, I had to have my life together, and that there wasn't really a place for me to have struggle or suffering or vulnerability. And so sort of backstory on my graduate school experience was that when I went to graduate school, I made a commitment to myself that I have a history of an eating disorder. And when I went to graduate school, I made a commitment to myself that my recovery would always be the most important thing. I was going to study eating disorders. So it's really important, right? And in my first year, I started struggling, and the stress of graduate school, the feeling incongruent about what I was doing there, and also missing my spirituality. And so that really being my roots led me to following through on that commitment. And I withdrew after my first year. Mm-hmm. And that's when I went to a yoga ashram and spent time at the El Dorado Mountain School of Yoga and found chanting and yoga and back to my spiritual roots again. And then when I went back to graduate school, I made this commitment, second commitment. And this is all value. Like, here are my values showing up, like sort of like your guitar gets out of tune and you got to do a little check of the strings, right? And so my guitar had been out of tune. I got tuned up again when I was in this yoga ashram, went back to graduate school, and I made a commitment to pursue research that was aligned with what I believed in. And at that time, the only evidence-based approach that was really alive was in graduate training, or that was popular, was DBT. So I ended up pursuing researching DBT for eating disorders. But along the way, I met Kelly Walson, came to a workshop and provided this little, it wasn't even a workshop, he provided this little like seminar for like 10 graduate students in Denver, and he had like a whiteboard and mapped out early, you know, on the whiteboard, the psychological processes for psychological flexibility. And he started crying and sharing about his experience of addiction, his experience of loss, his experience of having a suicide in his family. And he was so incredibly vulnerable, while at the same time, so highly respected in the field. And it was this aha moment of, I don't have to hide my vulnerabilities. Like, actually, my vulnerabilities can be here, and I can kind of get out of the closet a little bit about, here I am dealing, like, I never shared in graduate school. I've very, very limitedly shared about my history with anorexia and my history of an eating disorder. You kind of assume when someone goes and gets their PhD that maybe there's something else going on, if she's getting her PhD in disorders and then runs a whole treatment center and it's so passionate about this topic, either her or her sister or brother or someone's got one, right? So, but yes, and in that moment when Kelly was so brave, and that was after so much bravery in his life to show up in that way, it encouraged me to be brave and have that bravery of, I can be fully me in my profession, in my career, in my life, and I can, and that is actually how I get tuned up. That's how I stay in tune with myself. Yeah. So that's the Kelly Walson story. And I love the man. I always love the man. And we have like our yoga connection. We got our barefoot connection. We're both nature lovers and run bare feet, barefoot. And, you know, he's been so influential to me in my career, but also just really personally.
That's really touching. Thanks so much for sharing all that. Yeah. Honestly, I think it's a really important message, because I know so many people, and I've had clients who are interested in becoming therapists or going into a helping profession, but are attached to this idea that they're not fixed yet, or they're not right, or there's something wrong with them. And so that means they couldn't go into that field. And people, stories like yours and Kelly's being out there and realizing that we're kind of all on this journey together of healing, and we can be on our healing journey and also be helping others at the same time.
Yeah. I mean, I think going back to that guitar example, and I'm using this metaphor purposefully with you, Thomas, because I know that you're into guitars. And I learned early on as a therapist, don't pick a metaphor. I've been doing a lot of metaphors that you may not relate to on this show, and like beekeeping and, but the metaphor of the guitar, I know you can dig.
So there's one sitting right behind me.
Yeah. I know you like your guitars, but the metaphor of the guitar is a good one.
It is. Because
you got to tune up regularly. Yeah. It's going to get out of tune. Just the nature of it sitting around, it gets out of tune, right? Just the weather change, it's out of tune. And how you tune the guitar is you play it and you listen.
Yeah.
And then you can go string by string, right? And so string by string may be the domains of my life. It may be like, how are my relationships doing with my friends? How's my health? My relationship with my health, the domain of health. How am I caring for my body right now? How's it going for me in my work and in doing meaningful work, right? So those are the strings of our guitar that we can go string by string and to make. Sometimes it's little micro adjustments, like, I just need to tweak this a little bit, right? Yes. And I need to add a little bit more rest in my life, a little bit more quiet time, right? To get me a little bit more tuned up. Sometimes it's big macro adjustments, like I need to withdraw from school. I need to lose this job.
Sometimes the string breaks.
Yeah. Sometimes a string breaks, this relationship is done, right? But I see that we, you know, sort of, if we start to tune in to the instruments of who of us, and then we start to see, and I'm also part of a band here. There's other people with their own guitars, and we're all playing the, and like, there's the harmony of it, right? And some instruments are doing this thing, and I'm doing this thing, and together we sound good. But I think that that's really what values are for me. And it's been, I have languaging for it now because of ACT. But it's been around for me for a long time. And I don't think anyone that recovers from an addiction or an eating disorder or whatever, a mental health condition, doesn't know, you know, that Shel Silverstein poem of like, I know what's right for me and I know what's wrong. Like no preacher, teacher, friend can tell me. It's inside of me. And being able to develop the skill to tune in to your values and the sound of your instrument and your, whether it's, you know, a little bit off, but that's just normal. It's going to be like that. Always kind of turning towards over and over and over again is the practice.
And what I love about that metaphor is your guitar going out of tune is expected. That's part of it. Mm-hmm. And so it's not seen as something being wrong, going a little out of tune or a lot out of tune. It's expected and it's part of the practice and the journey of life to just continually checking in and coming back into tune over and over and over again.
And we give musicians time to tune up.
Yeah.
We don't, we wait, we step back, we give whatever time you need to tune up. They take it. It's important, right? So what if we gave each other the time to tune up? And we didn't think you just had to keep, just rush in and play the song. Whether it's the time to tune up when you need to take a little time before you go to college, kid. I need to tune up. And I like, you don't need to rush through 17 years old, 18 years old, off to school. Or you need to take a little time in the middle of your life, right? Or a time in your day, in your work day to tune up. Or a time in a conversation with somebody.
Yes. We need to normalize tuning up. Like I try to model for that with clients. Like if, and I'm sure you do too, in the middle of a session, if you're feeling scattered or lost, or you didn't hear something they say, normalize pausing and breathing and kind of refocusing. We should be able to have those moments in the middle of a conversation to really tune back up and re-engage fully in a conversation with somebody.
Yeah, absolutely. And it sounds better.
Yeah. Wonderful. Well, thank you so much, Diana. I love this conversation.
I loved it too. Thank you for having me on. And it's just a real treat to be a fellow traveler with you in the podcasting world, in the ACT world, the spirituality world. We have a lot in common and a lot of similar values and interests. And you're just a delight to be with. So thank you for welcoming me on your show.
Oh, all the same to you. And I'll make sure to post links in the show notes for your book and how people can find you. But is there anything you'd want to say now as we come to a close?
I don't think so. I think you got a lot covered.
Okay, wonderful. Well, thank you again.
Take care.
It's got me out of my mind. It's got me seeing trees breathe. It's got me learning how heaven and hell are both inside of me. It's got me feeling the love that I bottled so deep, when the entire world kept feeding on my greed. Yes, I know, I'll never know, but I can close my eyes, take a deep breath and try to open my soul. Oh yes, I know, I'll never know, but I can close my eyes, take a deep breath and try to open my soul.